Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by journalist, academic and media campaigner, Professor Brian Cathcart. Brian started his career as a correspondent at Reuters, working in London, Paris and The Hague. In 1986, he moved to the newly launched paper, The Independent, and quickly rose through the ranks to become deputy editor at The Independent on Sunday. In 2003, whilst working as a freelance journalist, he joined Kingston University as a founding member of their journalism department. An expert on policing, injunctions and gagging orders, he was made a professor in 2006. He was appointed an advisor to the House of Commons Media Select Committee at a time when they were investigating the phone hacking scandal. In light of this work, he co-founded the campaign group Hacked Off with the Media Standards Trust. The group successfully campaigned for a public inquiry into phone hacking, which became the Leveson Inquiry, and now campaigns for the implementation of its recommendations. On top of this, he has won the Orwell Prize for Political Writing, writes regularly for The New Statesman, and recently published his eighth book, The News from Waterloo. Brian, thanks for joining me.
A pleasure.
So how did it all start then? Did you always want to be a journalist?
I don't know. I think I probably wanted to be a historian, really. When I finished at university, I thought it was probably more important to get a job. And I was brought up in Ireland, and I think I also quite fancied leaving Ireland. I applied for lots of jobs, including jobs at the BBC and at Reuters. And in fact, I only ever got one interview
at Reuters,
which was at Reuters. And very fortunately, I landed the job.
And what was the job? What were you doing?
It was as a trainee journalist, which was then an astonishing leap into Fleet Street, direct into Fleet Street. I had no idea how lucky I was, actually. But, you know, I finished my university finals on a Thursday. And I started work at Reuters in 85 Fleet Street on the following Monday at the age of 21. I had, you know, done none of the normal things that pass in between. And it was only sort of 10 or 15 years later that I realized I had had a sort of, I'd cut out 10 years of most journalists' careers.
Kind of struggling at the bottom, as it was. It's amazing. The biggest eyebrow raiser from that is that there were still media organizations at Fleet Street even then.
Oh, well, yeah, everybody was still at Fleet Street. I'm afraid I'm that old. We're talking 1978.
Oh, so, well, of course.
Everybody was still in Fleet Street. I mean, you looked out the window at the Express and the Telegraph. The street was probably choked with lorries bearing giant rolls of newsprint, heading, in many cases, for the Sun or the News of the World, which was the world's biggest consumer of that stuff.
Pre-whopping, of course.
And pre-whopping. And, I mean, all the pubs were full of journalists.
Was it good networking in the pubs, as it were, then? Because you're all in one location. I mean, now everyone's all over the place, literally.
It wasn't. There were sort of little pubs that were four places. So the Reuters people drank in a pub called Mrs. Moon's, or alternatively in the Old Bell. Whereas other newspapers and news organisations drank in different pubs. I mean, I remember our rivals at the Associated Press drank in the Hoop and Grapes around the corner on Farringdon Road. So you could, there were places where you would meet people from other papers, but you could also just hang out with your own, as it were, outfit.
Your own crew.
Your own crew. And it was quite nice that way, actually. But, of course, it was also a very heavy drinking environment.
Well, journalism still is. It's one of the few professions where you're still allowed to get blotto, aren't you, on the expenses tab?
Well, maybe. I think, actually, in my lifetime, that's reduced quite a bit. Certainly lunchtime drinking and drinking in your break in the evening, I think that's, if not gone entirely, vastly reduced. I mean, it was perfectly normal for a whole shift, as it were, to spend 2 hours in the pub or an hour and a half in the pub in the evening, return to the desk having had, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 pints of bitter.
So when you're at Reuters, that's your first job. What were your initial impressions of the job? Were there any kind of shocks? You were doing it for real at that point. What were the kind of key learnings where you thought, oh, this is new?
I mean, one of the things about going to direct into Reuters from university was that you got to make your mistakes on the biggest possible stage. I mean, it was just mortifying. Some of my mistakes are incredibly vivid to me now, and I won't repeat them. They still cause me deep discomfort. But you had access. Of course, you were subbed and you were edited, but they can't spot the mistakes in your original writing. So, I mean, it's high stakes, and there were days when I thought, they're going to throw me out of this organization. I'm never going to make it in journalism. But somehow it worked out, and it was an excellent training. Reuters had particularly high standards when it came to attribution, to sourcing, so forth. They had, you know, I mean, in an organization that, for example, sold its news supply to newspapers in and governments in Egypt and Syria and Jordan, as well as to governments and newspapers in Israel, obviously you've got to source your material writing about the Middle East very, very carefully. And that applied all over the world from everywhere they were reporting. So the rules and the standards were very, very high. And I'm very, very grateful to have had that training.
And did you know at that point that choosing journalism was the right course of action then, that you were always going to be in journalism, as it were?
Well, I loved it from day one. I mean, absolutely loved it. You know, I was already, I'd read newspapers from quite a young age. If you grow up, as I did, in Belfast during the Troubles, now I was nowhere near the front line, but I was there, you were exposed continually to argument and politics. And I got really hooked on news then. And so finding myself as a journalist was just fantastic. I loved it. I was, you know, actually, as it were, making a living, being allowed to make a living out of the thing that was really obsessing me at the time, yeah.
And back then, was a kind of job like Reuters a job for life, or did you expect to kind of stay there a certain number of years and then progress?
A lot of people stayed a long time. Yeah, I think I probably at that stage expected it to be a long, long career. There are cultural things that have changed. I was, you know, I met the woman who is my wife now when I was at university, so I was attached already at a young age, and you quickly realise that the business of being shunted around the world with your partner is going to cause either impossible stress to you and your wife or to you and your employer.
And is that how you came to be at The Independent then? Did you find an opening and then apply for it in the traditional sense, or were you headhunted?
Headhunted would be putting it nicely. A bunch of people from Reuters went to join the foreign desk of the Independent at launch. We were mostly Times and Reuters people. I was one of the last of them to make the, as it were, crossover. I think it was 3 weeks before the launch of the paper that I arrived.
Wow. So you were there from day minus 21.
Something like that, yeah. Certainly, just as we launched the period of producing regular daily dummies, which was quite famous at the time, we were just kicking in as I arrived. I missed all the sitting around doing nothing period.
And was it kind of very exciting and hellishly stressful at the same time? I can imagine you look back upon it now fondly, but I imagine at the time it might have been quite stressful.
Funnily enough, I think, you know, when you're that young, I don't think you worry so much about the risks. I think now, you know, I would think, oh my God, you know, this thing could go belly up in 3 weeks and I could be looking for a job again. But then I just loved the ride, and they were fantastic people. I mean, they are fantastic people. Around you at the Independent in those days, you'd find Bill Bryson, Sebastian Faulks, Mark Lawson. I mean, lots of, you know, very talented, very brilliant people who were journalists with their sleeves rolled up. On the foreign desk, you know, we were working with Alexander Chancellor, John Litchfield, John Bullock, brilliant people, Isabel Hilton. And they were examples to follow and all that. I was dazzled and I was absolutely thrilled by the experience.
What was Andreas Whittam Smith like to work for?
Andreas was a very fine editor, I think. A very patient, cautious man. Not, you know, he was known for the red mists. he could lose his temper, but actually,
they all can, kind of, these editors.
Yeah,
there.
He was actually fairly economical about that. I think he was, in my experience, somebody who pretty well always listened to reason and had an open mind.
Because you were there for quite some time, weren't you?
I was there for 11 years, yeah.
A long time.
Moving on into the Sunday paper as well, 11 years, yeah. Through quite a lot of ups and downs.
Tell us a few of them. Well, let's go through the ups first. Let's go through some highlights.
The launch, I mean, it was a fantastic sort of succès d'estime at the beginning, mm. And everybody talked about the Independent. People associate the problems with the launch of the Sunday, but it was also a time when that happened at a time disastrously when the advertising market collapsed. Mm. And the Independent, being new and small, had fewer resources to fall back on, and it got in, you know, it got into difficulty. Difficulties, you know, which meant that the sales of the paper started to decline, and it never has really had the power to turn that around since then, or very rarely for short periods.
Was there always a sense of mission, though, at the paper, given that it had been set up to be literally independent?
Yes, I think there were missions to do with, in Foreign News, which was where I started there, a mission to bring, you know, a high level of explanation, a good quality of independent reporting from around the world, and to, you know, to stand up for your reporters, and to raise the bar. I mean, if you look back, at the time the Independent launched foreign reporting was in the doldrums in this country. It was a page and a half in most newspapers.
A kind of token effort just to tick a box.
Yeah, I mean, more than that perhaps with the Telegraph and maybe the Times, but not much more. I think you would have found that pretty well all the foreign editors would have felt they were in serious retreat, getting rid of reporters around the world and all that sort of thing. And the Independent arrived and was determined to do it big. And it, you know, raised the bar for everybody else. It increased the space that all the other papers gave to foreign news. So it was a shot in the arm for that. And I think we all felt that and you know, felt good about it. When I moved to the Sunday paper, I was on the foreign side at the start. And then I moved into more general editing, working with Ian Jack and Peter Wilby, which was inspiring and brilliant and educational and just great fun.
So you moved to the Sunday and you're on the foreign desk, and then when the upper echelons came calling and you made deputy editor, was there a moment where you thought, do I want to remain a kind of active journalist producing copy? Because when you move into those kind of upper echelons, you're into management and editing, which is a different job. And, you know, some of the journalists I know want to remain journalists, and some of them are fiercely ambitious and always think, I do want to be a journalist, so only so I can get to editor, though. It's like a stepping stone.
Yes, I'd enjoyed my time. For example, I spent time at Reuters and at The Independent as a sub-editor, and I loved sub-editing. I mean, you know, and you'll find lots of people out there who'll say the same thing. It's a great job.
It is, isn't it?
And so it's sort of undervalued people. It's quite hard to explain to students why sub-editing is such fun, but it is. And so, you know, editing is an extension of that. You're trying to work out how to make things work best for the reader, the presentation, all that sort of thing. And then as you move up, you're making more sort of editorial judgments. But I always felt it was just another branch of the same thing. And I don't suppose I ever thought I was going to give up writing, except in, you know, temporary senses. I was never restless about that side of thing. I never thought this was farewell to reporting or to sort of publishing what I thought, that sort of thing.
If you don't mind me asking, though, I mean, deputy editor is one rung on the ladder beneath editor and then onward toward global domination, you know. Did you think that this was the start of a kind of editing career and that you'd take the helm at a larger paper later on?
At one stage, I applied to be the editor of the Independent on Sunday, and I didn't get the job, which was probably the right decision. I mean, it's a curious thing. Having come from Reuters and having worked for 11 years at The Independent, I actually didn't have a great network of connections at other papers. So I don't think I ever thought I would, you know, walk into a job elsewhere very, very readily. I hadn't never put myself around in the way that, you know, that might have been a possibility. So I don't think, aside from that one, application, I don't think I ever thought I was going to be an editor.
Because before you moved on to Kingston University, you were freelance at that point, weren't you? So was there a time when you formally moved away from the paper?
I think you could say I moved away. You could say I was fired.
Well,
when Rosie Boycott took over as editor of The Independent on Sunday, I was the deputy editor. And rather like a football manager, she wanted her own deputy editor.
It always happens.
And I arrived in the office one morning to be told I didn't have a job. And, I mean, they were all very nice to me and all that sort of thing. But I went off then to freelance and to write books.
It's incredibly brutal, though, isn't it? I mean, to walk in, you know, your deputy editor, things are going well, there's a new editor. I mean, were you expecting it, though? Because like you say, when a new editor comes in, it's often they do want their people. And it's no slight on you, is it? It's just you're not someone she knew.
Yes. I mean, a colleague had tipped me off. But, I mean, you didn't have to be a genius to know that that's what editors do.
To try and
brutal.
Make it.
I mean, it was fairly soft for me, I think. The Independent by then was experiencing something that a lot of other papers have since experienced, which is, you know, successive rounds of cuts. So I had seen a lot of people go out the door before I went, and indeed a lot of people went out the door after I went. I think I had a fairly easy time of it, actually.
It's strange because when you read on Press Gazette that the Telegraph and the Independent and all these papers are slashing yet more staff, I wonder how they can do that, because I literally think, well, who's left?
Well, you know, absolutely.
Who can they fire?
I mean, sometimes on The Independent on Sunday, it felt like one of those competitions to see how few people you could get out a newspaper with.
Mm.
I mean, it was skeleton, and then you thought they're taking away bones, you know.
Yes. No, I've heard that from a few people. So how was freelance life for you?
I was quite lucky because I stumbled almost straight away into something which turned out to be very big, which was I was asked to write a magazine piece about the Stephen Lawrence case. And I wrote the magazine piece, and by the time I'd finished it, I knew there was probably going to be a book in this. Some events had to unfold, but there was probably going to be a book in it. And in fact, they set up an inquiry into the Lawrence case. I reported the inquiry for the New Statesman, and I wrote a book on the basis of what I'd learned and picked up. So all of that filled a lot of the, you know, 2 or 3 years that followed for me pretty fully. The Lawrence book is a big, fat book, and it was a big, complicated issue.
How immersed in the inquiry were you emotionally, if you don't mind me asking? Because it's easy to say, oh, yes, the Met are institutionally racist and Doreen Lawrence lost her son. You know, this is years and years later. I still feel terrible for her. But, I mean, living it every day, you must have...
Yes, it was...
really upset you.
It was a stressful thing, certainly. I mean, you know, anybody who does reporting in court, for example, knows the experience. And in some ways, court cases, because they're shorter, are more shocking and brutalising. I think that the inquiry, because it was so long, it became, I suppose, kind of Stockholming in a way. I, you know, by the end of it, I knew everybody at the inquiry on all sides. I was on, I think, reasonable terms with them all. And, you know, and also some of the regulars in the public gallery, because inquiries and trials, as you know, attract regulars. So, we were all in a strange kind of bubble. But it was also a real challenge. I mean, I saw the daily reporters trying to cover it, and I could see that there was a sort of gap of understanding, writing things as impactful news stories day after day. Was
the
distorting the way that
you lose the nuance.
It was hard to recognise sometimes the what I had seen in court when you read about it in the papers. It's not really a criticism of then, but it's a criticism of I suppose daily journalism as a limited format. So I was very glad to be writing a book, and as it turned out, a very long book, going into as much as I could every corner of the story and trying to give a really balanced account of it.
In terms of the impact that the book had, do you think that the Met took it seriously? I mean, what did you hear anecdotally in terms of, you know, behind the scenes, what difference it made?
Some police officers took it very seriously, and I was, you know, I was very touched. It's only a few days since I met a police officer, a very senior police officer from the time, just at a sort of random social event, and he came up to me and he started talking about the book. I mean, you know, that's a source of great pride to me. I mean, the book isn't perfect, and it stops at the end of the public inquiry, the McPherson report. So all that's happened since, you know, changes our perspective to a degree. But I'm very, very proud of the book. And I think, you know, for a while I sat on a police advisory committee, a police training advisory committee and things like that. I got engaged with those issues. And indeed, I still occasionally get asked to write about race and policing and those things. So some police officers took it seriously and some public officials took it seriously. I think some didn't. Couldn't wait to get, you know, to bury it.
What do you think the Met's position is now? Do you think they are trying to do something about it in terms of what is termed institutional racism?
Yes. I wonder. I have been watching events in the United States recently and wondering, you know, the two possible reactions that you could imagine here. One would be to say, oh, yes, we've been through all that. As it were, we're dealing with it. And one would say, well, that reminds me, we must do more ourselves. And I would like to think they took the latter view and were, you know, actually thinking again about how to deal with these things. I mean, you know, a simple measure, which everybody knows, I think, is that stop and search of young black people and Asian people is higher, considerably higher than it was at the time that McPherson reported.
You would have expected, given the impactful nature of the report and your book, that things would have dropped.
Yeah, you'd expect a rebalancing, but it's simply never happened. Why that is, you know, is I think you go back and you read McPherson and you'll get some sort of measure of why it's happening, why it hasn't been fixed. I mean, it's difficult. Nobody ever said it would be easy, but there's clearly still a way to go.
I'm sure you'd agree, though, we're not as bad as America insofar as, you know, when the Met do kill people by accident, like I'm thinking of Mark Duggan and Jean-Charles de Menezes, that there's a huge public inquiry and a massive outcry, whereas in America, I'm not suggesting it's a daily occurrence, but, you know, the police are killing hundreds of people a year accidentally, not as an isolated example. I mean, the scale is so much bigger, even, you know, accounting for...
The scale of everything in America is bigger. I always guard against that defence, which is that it's worse somewhere else. That's no comfort to black people in this country.
No, agreed.
and indeed, nobody should be trying to present it as such. I think it's the sort of thing that we white people say to each other to reassure ourselves.
We're just guilty of that very thing, are we not?
Yes, indeed.
How did you get into academia then? How did the world of academia come calling?
I was working, I think, at the New Statesman at the time.
Freelance?
Part-time, on the editing side, and I was doing some writing. And
who was the editor back then?
That was John Kampfner.
Oh, famous.
I think that's right. And I was approached by a friend who worked at Kingston to help. Would I help write a module for a media studies course or about journalism? And I helped. And then they came back not long after. Well, we think this could be turned into a half field, what's called a half field. So it's half a degree. So you do journalism and something else. So I helped with that. And then they came back and said, would you like to teach this? And so I applied, got appointed, and there were two of us at the very beginning then. And it built up into what is now a very big, bustling department with several degree courses and postgrad courses. And thriving.
And when you were offered the job, was that a full-time position? So there was a conscious decision to leave your other projects and dedicate yourself full-time to that course?
I think in the first year or so, it was a half-time. I worked for a short period at both the Independent and the New Statesman. Anybody who's worked had two 0.5 jobs will tell you that somehow adds up to more than one.
Yes.
It was running me ragged. So before very long, I gave it up. I gave up the New Statesman job. I took on a column for the Statesman instead, and I went and worked pretty well full time for Kingston.
I mean, as you can see, as you've already outlined, the department is incredible now. It's bustling, it's huge, and it's delivering. I mean, again, if you don't mind me asking, what were your ambitions then? I mean, were you clearly to build up the department into something of substance?
The ambition really was to produce a course, to teach a course that would give journalists both a decent practical basis. And, in fact, we were then thinking of ourselves as a kind of a written journalism, not just print, but written journalism. So focus on that, get them to be good written journalists, good editors, and at the same time give them an understanding of the ethical surroundings and the history and so forth, the background to why they're doing it, really. We try to keep a balance between those. There are sort of essay-based modules and there are practical-based modules. I wouldn't know what the balance in terms of percentages was, but we try to turn out people who can go into the newsroom and think as well as write.
Do you think drive is just as important as ability? Because I've seen that in colleagues in the PR industry that are more talented than I am, way more talented, but lazier, and therefore I have leapfrogged them from time to time.
I can never answer that one, really.
It's difficult.
I think, first of all, I'm dealing with mostly with undergraduates, and you'd have to say that undergraduates in journalism are not unlike undergraduates in a great many other fields. So they work when they want to or when they absolutely have to, not necessarily consistently throughout. So I don't see them, you know, as always as fantastically driven, although there are some who are. But I suppose, you have to have some native talent that you can deploy. But there's a lot that work can do.
When was the first that you heard from the Commons Media Select Committee? When did they come calling?
I underwent a kind of conversion while the McCann scandal was unrolling. So at the beginning, my reflex to the coverage of the McCann thing was, well, hey, these people have employed a media advisor. You know, they're in there. They're played down and dirty. That's the way it is. And after a while, I realized that what was happening to them was off the scale of morality.
It was incredible. Clarence Mitchell, of course, famously was their media guy.
Yes. And could not be justified on any terms and ought to make every journalist ashamed. And
agreed.
I wrote a piece quite far down the road. I wrote a long piece for The Statesman condemning what had happened and condemning the complacency of the press for failing to confess to what had gone wrong and to investigate themselves what had gone wrong so that something would be put right. The old thing, if it had happened in any other industry, they would have been demanding an inquiry.
Mm.
It happened in their own industry. They were just trying to bury it. And I was, you know, pretty angry about that, and I wrote a strongly worded piece.
And the motivation purely is just sensationalism to sell papers?
Yes.
At its most base?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And a sort of unthinking competitiveness.
Who cares if you destroy a family still further and wrongly tar them with the fact that they might have been involved in the disappearance of their daughter?
Yeah, and think, you know, I'm teaching young journalists what the job is, and they're seeing a paper, seeing several papers, that are quite happy to make things up every day.
Mm.
And that, I think, was, you know, that was shocking. I wrote a piece. It caught the eye of some of the members of the DCMS committee, the Culture, Media and Sport Committee. And they were, in fact, they had announced an inquiry into press standards, press regulation, privacy, I think it was. Mm. Libel, privacy, press standards, something like that.
Was John Whittingdale chair at the time?
Yes. I was asked to be an advisor, and I was very happy to do so. And
so how does that work? Forgive me, because I actually don't know the answer to this question. You're an advisor to a select committee. What does it involve?
I think I'd do a better job now than I did then, in a sense, because I have a better perspective of it. But there are several things. You advise in terms of saying who should be, and if you can help, you help. Who should be asked to give evidence? You advise in what kind of questions might be asked. You collate evidence from previous witnesses and turn those into new questions for the next witnesses. You're
so you
providing,
sit through all the hearings then?
Absolutely.
And hear the evidence firsthand.
Absolutely,
right,
everyone. And you sit, you provide backup for basically a bunch of very busy MPs. Some of whom who have no particular expertise. It's one of the odd things about that committee is that it was, you know, at that time very concerned with the forthcoming Olympic Games, which were part of its remit. It was also taking an interest in things at the Opera House and stuff to do with Ofcom, none of which was relevant to this particular inquiry. So and then, as I say, the MPs have all got constituencies to worry about and all that sort of stuff. So you're providing a backup for them and helping. You know, it's a bit like editing, actually, helping organise the information. They have clerks as well, but you're just providing this sort of expert input.
And what was your motivation in terms of working with them? Because you'd written this piece for the New Statesman about how terribly the McCanns were treated. Were you hoping to have some influence in terms of their ultimate report so that it would call for the requisite change?
No, I wouldn't like to think that I'd have had influence. I didn't have influence. I mean, I was able to help, but you don't get to make suggestions to the MPs about what their report should say. That's for the witnesses.
Of course.
You don't get to write their report. That is their business. And, you know, that you don't get to write their recommendations. You give what input you can. I think what I got out of it, you'd have to ask them what they got out of my contribution, but what I got out of it was a grandstand seat at a big investigation, and it was a big investigation, which happened at the time that the phone hacking scandal was breaking.
Mm.
So in the middle of this inquiry, Nick Davis produced his sensational revelation about Gordon Taylor and the hacking of his phone. And that was the thing that really turned the whole thing, blew the whole thing open. And in the weeks and months that followed, the committee saw a lot of people. It brought some people back to question them again. To ask them about the phone hacking and what was going on. And it got quite a lot of lies from quite a lot of people. What we would now know are lies from people. There was a serious attempt to cover it up, discredit the committee, discredit committee members, and so forth. As I say, I had a grandstand seat at all of that. So I had a pretty deep knowledge of the hacking issue.
And you must have seen the injustice and become quite angry because you then moved from advisor to activist. I mean, you could have been an advisor to Hacked Off, but instead you were part of the genesis of actually setting it up and moving into full campaigning mode. Tell us about how that worked.
Well, it's interesting that you put it that way because actually I think it was quite an important transition for me. Having been a journalist who wrote about things and tended, write about things and walk away in a way, to being somebody who wanted to change things and wanted to do more than just draw attention to a problem, but actually take part in trying
to fix it. Be
part
of the solution. Yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, in the once the committee had reported, I was no longer involved. Immediately out of the way, and I was then free because I had not been able to write during that period I was advising. It's more than a year. Write about these issues. So I was then free to write, and I had a lot of knowledge, and I wrote, in fact, on the Index on Censorship website, quite a lot of blogs about the unfolding hacking scandal. Hacked Off emerged because Martin Moore of the Media Standards Trust and I became concerned that actually News of the World, News International was going to get away with it.
Mm.
They were starting to pay off some of the civil litigants, and they were maintaining a sort of blockade on the criminal side.
Was the line still one rogue reporter at this point?
They were beginning to admit up to a point which they thought they could, a line which they thought they could defend. And I thought they might get away with it, and so did Martin. And we thought there has to be a public inquiry. It's got to be dragged out before it goes any further, you know, before it slips away. Before the, you know, there were at that time, we had the first evidence that email files were being deleted on a large scale, for example. So that was very alarming.
Servers were being sent away to be reformatted, and it was said that it was a routine deleting.
All of that stuff. The story emerged, I think, of the email that was sent by somebody senior in News International saying, how are things progressing with the email deletion policy?
Why would you email? I mean, you know, if I'm ever going to conspire against anyone now, I'll just ring them up from a payphone.
I know.
Yeah, I've learnt so many things now in how to go about shady business. Because you look back now and think, well, why would they even do that? It just looks dodgy.
Well, I mean, I saw it, as I said, from a fairly long perspective. I had, I've been interested in the McCann case. Phone hacking came along. We looked at the failures, the committee had looked at the failures of the PCC, which was now exposed as a sham. I mean, really, as an absolute sham. And so, you know, I could see a broad picture, not just of journalistic failure and abuse, but of cruelty. And a lot of people who had suffered a lot as a result of this breakdown of ethical standards.
Because now it's common knowledge. You know, families were torn apart by this.
Absolutely. And you know, people make light of it because some of these families, you know, the person at the centre was famous or rich or both. But I think it simply doesn't excuse it. You know, when you think that, for example, Charlotte Church's parish priest had his phone hacked, he was among 20 or so people in her circle who were hacked. And she had no idea where all these leaks were coming from and was, as others have testified, was turning away from people, was accusing people. She was being driven into a state of paranoia.
And in a sense, you couldn't blame her because there was intimate aspects of her life. She's only telling her trusted inner circle that each one individually she trusts, and there was the information being, you know, leaked into the papers. It must have been someone.
And this was, I always have in my mind the analogy of the Stasi. They would maintain a multifaceted surveillance on targets, which would include phone tapping, following them around, questioning their friends, and so forth. And that was what was happening with these people. It was like the Stasi, but it was being run by a national newspaper.
Do you think they had any empathy for their victims at all? Or do you think it was just like the Stasi, where they didn't consider these celebrities human? Or they just thought, well, it's par for the course, they're celebs. You know, they want to get in the paper anyway, so we might as well hack their phones and reveal a few juicy tidbits that they don't want out.
Well, I mean, talking to some of the people, not just celebrities, who've been on the wrong end of this, you get the impression that the journalists, and particularly the newspaper managements, had taught themselves to hate them. They hated these people. They hated them because they were fighting back. They hated them because they were rich. They hated them because they were famous. They hated them for whatever reason. But they had taught themselves that these were, in a sense,
the enemy, evil
people who deserved everything that was coming to them.
They've done that very conveniently in their minds, psychologically, to justify ruining their lives for a little few bob extra.
Yes, and you know, when you think that the targets included the Dowlers, I mean, it's breathtaking.
Do you think that was the turning point then? Because I followed it with interest because I work in the media, but I remember when the Millie Dowler splash happened on The Guardian, that was when, you know, quote-unquote regular people, people like my mum who aren't media types, said, oh, no, this has gone far too far. You know, that is interfering with a criminal investigation now. Something has to be done. Did you feel that that was the turning point?
Yes, I think the earth moved. I mean, I think that the way that you can measure that is that that was the moment at which suddenly in Parliament, MPs from all parties were standing up and saying, look, I'm guilty here. I have indulged the pressures. I've been to the parties. I have not done things because I was afraid of what the press would do to me. And we have to stop this now. And literally all parties, they were standing up and it was like a sort of evangelist meeting. I think that was a very big moment. And it was then that David Cameron said, there will be an inquiry. And we at Hacked Off and others set about making sure it was the right kind of inquiry. It wasn't an inquiry, you know, with the best will in the world. There had been 6 or 7 previous inquiries into the press, none of which had got anywhere. So we
seemed to be bigger and more profound.
To make sure
it was
a thoroughgoing inquiry and it was fully independent. We were very adamant, and indeed there was no resistance to this, that the inquiry should have a clear in its remit that it would not interfere with freedom of expression.
And did you feel any responsibility, both practically and ethically, to kind of steer the inception of it in terms of, you know, who was going to be appointed to run it, or did you have any influence
on it? None of that. I mean, I think we had a clear picture of where our responsibilities towards the victims for whom we spoke, for example, and we were at that stage. For example, we went to see the Prime Minister with the Dowler family. We had a clear picture that it had to be an inquiry, as it were, worthy of the circumstances and one that would rise above the failures of the past. And we were determined to see that, but not so presumptuous as to say who should be on it or who should be advising it or anything like that.
And during the inquiry itself, because it was quite a lengthy inquiry, you clearly, a bit like when you're an advisor to the Commons Select Committee thing, you wouldn't know what Brian Leveson was going to come out and say at the end of it. You might have got an inkling from the hearings, but he could have come out and said that you know, long live the press, let them do what they want, slap on the wrist.
Absolutely. I mean, I was pretty confident right from the start that there would be strong recommendations for change. The PCC had failed so badly that was, I think, inevitable. And at that stage, the leading figures in the press, including Lord Guy Black, for example, of the Telegraph Group, were admitting in public that the PCC had failed. Mm. They've since rewritten history, some of them, but that was the state of play. And I think that there was a confidence, I think, that some substantive change would come. But up until the day the report was published, we had no idea what actually he would recommend. And he didn't drop many hints. The one thing he kept saying was that I will, whatever happens, you won't find me meddling with freedom of expression.
During the inquiry and before, did you ever feel that the celebrities that were getting involved, because clearly they're victims, that was a kind of double-edged sword, that you had to make it, you know, that whilst you did have the attention from the press, from Hugh Grant and Steve Coogan and all of these, that you use that positively? Because when you actually read their stories, they were appalling and they had every right to be annoyed and get active. But there was a kind of lazy, shallow interpretation that, oh, this is just celebs, you know, complaining about a few voicemails.
Yes, I mean, it was certainly an issue. And I think people like Hugh Grant and Steve Coogan were very conscious of it themselves. They, I think if you look back, were always extremely cautious and careful to insist that it was the experiences of the people like Christopher Jeffries and the McCanns and of vulnerable people. I think of the Bowles families. The family, the various other lesser-known families, not, as it were, celebrity-related families, who had suffered most, because these people are vulnerable and have less power.
I mean, the coverage of Christopher Jeffries in particular, I remember that as being unhinged at the time. I remember the Attorney General himself saying, come on, guys, calm down. You know, I'm obviously paraphrasing.
Yeah, no, but, well, he did.
And that was
and
at
indeed,
the time.
And indeed, he prosecuted them.
I'm rightly so.
And they received fines of around £20,000, I think, to newspapers. Pathetic. I Yes. I mean, the Christopher Jeffries thing, I think, was just another... It was a sort of... It was proof that these organisations are and were unable to stop themselves.
Mm.
They have a code of practice which they ignore. It's just completely irrelevant to them when it comes to a big competitive story. It goes out the window if it was there in the first place. They will do anything, and they will make up anything. I mean, 9 newspapers stood up in court in the Christopher Jeffries case and admitted that the stories they wrote about him were without foundation.
Incredible. Literally incredible.
Yeah.
Leveson produces his report. Then there seems to be a melee lasting, many, many months where there's... I mean, at one point, I kind of just started skim reading the reports of it because I didn't know who was the good guys. You know, it was like shifting sands all the time.
It was. It was a difficult period. There's no doubt about it. And it was an indication of the tactics of the big papers.
Which were deliberate, clearly.
Yeah. They were determined that nothing should change and that they would sandbag and resist and misrepresent. Leveson was painstakingly careful to construct a model of press regulation that would be entirely respectful of freedom of expression.
I read the report. I was actually there the day he presented it to the newsman. I was sitting next to Peter Jukes, of all people,
right,
chatting. So.
Well, yes. I mean, he was incredibly painstaking about that. And the structure that he produced is precisely that. It is a means of raising the standard of press regulation without state interference. The state's role is to create an arm's length, rigorously independent body which will do no more than assess whether press regulators or regulators of news publishers, because it's not just the press, it's online as well, whether their regulators meet appropriate standards. That's to say, whether they are effective, whether they're independent, and whether they will provide the public with a decent service.
I've got kind of 2 questions in one now, which is that, you know, what do you think are the causes of the fact that we still have a mess now? And what do you think will happen next? I mean, we can't carry on with the way it is. It's beyond messy.
It is beyond messy. I think that we are paying at the moment the price for that very care that Leveson took. That's to say, the body that he recommended establishing, the recognition panel, has been set up. But setting it up in such a way that it was absolutely independent of government or parliamentary interference meant going through elaborate rituals of an appointments panel to appoint the appointments panel, as it were, and so forth. And that has been incredibly slow.
Rigorously rigorous.
They have the recognition panel, but the recognition panel itself is going through, somewhat to my frustration, but they are convinced this must happen, a public consultation process about how they should conduct their business. Now, you know, you can't argue with it. It makes me frustrated, but you can't argue with it. So it's extremely slow. And at the same time, setting up a recognisable and a sort of Leveson standard regulator is also slow. But Impress are well on their way. They're going to seek recognition. I'm sure that they will meet the standards required. And they will be regulating within, I would like to think, although I've made predictions of this kind before, I would like to think within a year they will be regulating quite a number of, I mean, not big national newspapers, but small news publishers around the country.
What do you think will happen to Ipso ultimately? I mean, could they end up the Betamax of press regulators, and then ultimately, there will be one? Because that's effectively what everyone wants.
I just think that Ipso is a hopeless case. If you look at the long decline of the PCC, it actually began with some standing. It was new. It was very well sold by the papers and sold by the politicians as well. In its last few years, its reputation was absolutely shredded, and the public came to see that this was, as I've said, a sham.
Mm.
Essentially, Ipso is starting from where the PCC left off, and that means it's in a deep hole. And because, of course, it's actually the PCC all over again.
Of course it is.
I mean, the changes are modest. Because of that, it's never going to get out of that hole. It will always have the problem that it's owned by the newspapers, that the owned, you know, that and they've meddled with their own supposedly independent appointments process to get the people they wanted. They're preserving a code that needs rewritten drastically. And the best example of all is that the chair of the committee that writes the code and that edits and maintains the code is the editor of the paper which we know breaks it most often.
Paul Dacre.
Paul Dacre.
My flabber is gusted. I knew that, but it's still shocking for you to say it. What do you think's next for Haktov then? Is it, do you anticipate that Haktov will eventually have to wind down when you've either won and, you know, you've got the Leveson's implementations, or do you think there'll always be some kind of need for it to exist just to keep on, you know, by way of attrition to get, eventually get there?
I seriously hope it doesn't have to be around for all that much longer.
Good.
I mean, I there is a job to be done, and that is to see this process through and see implementation through. And the it's going to continue to be a bumpy ride. There is no doubt that the newspapers think they're going to get away with it. And my concern really is that I hope that they can be brought to see sense and see the merits of the Leveson system and the Royal Charter system without there having to be another Dowler moment, because that's what they do, you know, and they can't stop it. As I say, the Christopher Jeffreys case shows that even when they were under maximum scrutiny, they still couldn't stop themselves behaving like this. They have done so in a number of cases since, which they may not be quite on that scale, but they are shocking in themselves. And I sincerely hope that we don't have to see some appalling outrage which causes the same sort of convulsion of public horror before they are brought to their senses.
Final question then. I mean, the old adage is if you want something done, ask a busy person, but you strike me as someone who's exceptionally busy. You've still got your career in academia, you're doing Haktov, and you've also written your eighth book. Tell us about all of that.
Well, I've just...
What time do you get up on a morning?
I don't know. I actually think of myself as a relatively lazy person, but I got interested in a story about how the news of Waterloo reached London. It arose out of some teaching, and I was looking something up, and it didn't make sense, and I started to try and make it make sense. And years later, I knew there was a book in it, and I also realised that I was never going to get it published if I didn't get it published in the year of the bicentenary.
It has to be this year.
So I have had
a sweaty deadline straight away, isn't it?
But I think that rather than it being a case of me working all the hours that God sent, I think I have enjoyed the support of a lot of people who have been very good, both at Kingston and at Haktov, and indeed at home. So I'm lucky in that way.
So how do you divide your time? Because often in my PR business, I'll move from one crisis to the next. Sometimes, you know, my fault, sometimes client's fault, as it were. But, you know, I look back at the end of a week and I've done all my work, but it's more by accident than design, as it were. Do you kind of plan your week out? Do you know on a Wednesday you're going to be at Haktov, on Thursday you're going to be teaching and writing your book on a Friday? How does it work?
You clearly haven't been talking to my friend. I think that anybody who knows me knows that I live in a kind of chaotic world. I like to think that it's something about the way my mind is, and it's not pure laziness. But I'm not one of those people who can see the diary in their heads. I just can't. And I'm not very efficient at keeping it either. So, you know, I can't see the next week in my head and say, oh, I know I'll be doing that next Tuesday, next Wednesday. I drive my wife to distraction because I constantly have to be reminded about things. And, I like to think it's a character flaw rather than a mental aberration rather than just pure laziness. But that's for others to judge.
Where will you be 10 years from now? You're still a young man.
I will be probably retired, although they seem to move the retirement age a year further away.
I'm just giving up on that. I mean, 110 before I get there.
But I will still be writing books. I want to write more more history of journalism. But I also like writing is probably the wrong word for books like the Stephen Lawrence book. I wrote another book about the murder of Jill Dando and the conviction of Barry George. I like to think I can, I'll be doing that sort of stuff as well. I do enjoy the teaching.
Well, I've learnt a huge amount. Brian, thank you ever so much for your time.
A great pleasure.
A Big Things Media production.
Big Things!